Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Joining me now is Jeffrey Salingo, editor-at-large of the Chronicle of Higher Education. His new book, College Unbound, The Future of Higher Education and What It Means for Students. Now, we all know about high tuition, student loans, not preparing for the new economy, but the book also offers lots of practical analysis about what's going right in higher ed as well. So we will hear some positive examples. Salingo is a big believer in the promise of online learning, for example. He highlights some of the schools he thinks are doing it right. So maybe Southern New Hampshire University may be the school for you. Jeffrey Salingo, welcome to WNYC.
It's great to be here.
So let's do one positive example and one negative example and start on the negative. You look at a school called Ohio Northern University, which I never heard of. And I don't think you want to single it out for any particular reason having to do with it, as opposed to that it's representative of something. But what's happening at Ohio Northern University?
Well, at places like Ohio Northern and a lot of small private colleges, to be honest with you, is that they don't have a lot of student aid to give out themselves because they have small endowments. And as a result, more and more students are going heavy into debt at places like that. It's not only students going into debt, but it's also parents going into debt. So there's been a huge run-up in student loan debt, but the undercovered story, I believe, is also that parent debt is going up. And in some cases, parents are being asked to take on $25,000, $30,000, $35,000 a year to pay for their children to go to college. And at the end of the day, it's the parents who are on the hook for that debt, not their students.
And so you contrast, for example, the average student debt coming out of Ohio Northern with that of Princeton. And the answer is not what most people would guess.
Right. Princeton, actually, I think the average debt is around about $5,000 because Princeton has generous aid programs. And the fact of the matter is that students coming out of Princeton make more money. And so 5 years, 10 years, 15 years out, the student coming out of Ohio Northern and other small private colleges like that may not be making as much money as the student from Princeton. And they're also paying three or four times as much in student loan debt.
There is pushback out there on the student loan question these days. As you probably know, there was an article in The Atlantic recently called The Myth of the Student Loan Crisis. And I have a quote from it which says, horror stories of students drowning in $100,000 debt may discourage people from enrolling in college, but they are as rare as they are terrifying. And it includes a stat that 43% of college students leave with under $10,000 in debt, and over 80% have under $25,000 in debt. So do the horror stories undercut the fact that most people aren't saddled in overwhelming debt compared to the amount of extra money that they're likely to make in their lifetimes with a college degree?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, a college degree is still well worth it. The question is it worth going to any college at any price? And I don't think it is anymore. And I think that students and parents need to be much savvier customers when it comes to picking colleges. Yes, so the average debt, undergraduate debt, is now $25,000. When you sometimes hear stories, horror stories of students $100,000 plus in debt, it's usually coming from law school and other types of graduate programs and professional programs.
And you point out that there isn't really any incentive for anyone along the way to say, listen, you may not be able to afford this college. The school isn't going to do it. They want your money. The parents aren't going to tell their kids they can't go to the college of their dreams. The government isn't really in a position to make those decisions. So who do you think could be responsible for saying, stop, rethink the long-term impact of this loan or this school?
I mean, this obviously has to be a family discussion. And the problem is that college, picking a college is a very emotional decision. We don't think about the finances of it until a couple of weeks before you need to make your decision because you don't even know how much you're going to pay to go to X college. It works just the opposite when you think about the other big purchase many of us make in life, and that's a home. We know before we go and even look at a home how much we can afford, how much we're pre-approved for, and so we only look at homes that we can actually afford. Many parents and students look at colleges that they can never afford.
Until the bubble of the last 10 years, of course, when all those bankers were out there telling you, you can afford this home. Don't worry. This rate mortgage starts at just 0.0% for the first year and a half.
Well, and I think colleges do the same thing. A lot in their marketing materials, they say, don't worry about the price of college. You know, you can take out loans. This is a lifetime investment.
President Obama promised the program in the State of the Union address to give more information about how much schools actually cost. Good start? Necessary program?
It's definitely a good start. It's called the College Scorecard. There's another tool called collegerealitycheck.com, which the Chronicle of Higher Education recently put out, which allows you to look at this return on investment. How much are you going to spend to go to a college, and how much are you going to get in return in terms of your paycheck later on?
Jeffrey Salingo, editor-at-large from the Chronicle of Higher Education. His new book, College Unbound, The Future of Higher Education and What It Means for Students. If you want to get in on this, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And let's take a call from Jennifer in South Brunswick. Hi, Jennifer. You're on WNYC.
Hi. How are you doing?
Okay.
I just wanted to say that the Ivy Leagues have this policy where there's like no student debt or low student debt, but they do increase the parental contribution expectation. They go very deeply into, like, if you're divorced, the non-custodial parents and even the non-custodial parents' spouses' possibility of contribution. What I ended up doing as a single mom was I called the Ivy League institution where my daughter was admitted, and I negotiated with the financial aid office and got them to increase her grant without increasing the parental contribution.
Thank you.
So there's
a good lesson for other parents out there. You can negotiate with your student's financial aid
office.
There's
definitely a lot of negotiation happening. And part of the problem is that there's no template for financial aid offers. So if you applied to five different schools and got accepted to five different schools, you're going to see five very different looking financial aid offers.
Huh.
So my suggestion is put them in a spreadsheet, compare them apples to apples, because sometimes in some ways these are marketing materials for the colleges. They're going to think you're getting a good deal when perhaps most of your financial aid offer is made up of loans.
And like with Ohio Northern versus Princeton, that has to do with how deep the pockets of the school are and how much they want your kid, because when people fill out the financial aid form, is it FAFSA?
Yes.
It's this unified form that all the colleges get.
Yeah, all the colleges get. But when you get the financial aid offer, which, by the way, you get after you get accepted and sometimes only a couple of weeks before you have to make a decision about where you're going, those forms do not look the same from college to college. And so some of them, it's called a package, and they package them in different ways. And again, some places make it look like you're getting a much better deal than you really are.
Is there a best argument to use with the financial aid office when you're trying to negotiate?
Well, I think that sometimes you could use what you've gotten from other schools. I think it's sometimes good to say, hey, I'm considering this other school, here's what I've gotten, show them that. That's usually helps in some cases.
Now, I mentioned South New Hampshire, or is it
Southern New Hampshire University.
Want to talk a little bit about them, since they seem to be mixing online and in-person courses in a way that you find interesting.
Yeah, so Southern New Hampshire is really serving many different types of students. They're serving the traditional undergraduate with a residential campus experience, but they also have a very large online-only program, in fact, the second largest now in New England. And the other interesting thing they've just started is a competency-based degree, which means that at most colleges – you have to go to class for so many hours a week in order to get credit, in order to get your degree. There's this new wave of degrees called competency-based degrees, which measures how much you already know. And if you already know, you move on to what you don't know. And it measures learning on what you don't know rather than time spent in a seat. And in many ways, people think that this has a way of reducing the amount of time to a degree, that you could potentially get a bachelor's degree in 2.5 years instead of 4 years. And they're experimenting with that now.
Is it possible today to get an education entirely online that is equivalent to a very good four-year college?
Possible, but not probable.
And are employers starting to think about coursework differently?
Sometimes employers don't know how much you got of your degree online, right? So, for example, in Southern New Hampshire, you're getting a Southern New Hampshire degree. So it's not clear to the employer that you got most of that online. Where I see a lot of the promise is in hybrid courses. So these are courses where students get the lectures online and they could watch it in a coffee shop or in their dorm late at night. And they're doing kind of the high impact stuff, one-on-one with a professor in class.
Noah in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. So I attend school in Quebec, where there was recently a big the whole province pretty much was on strike against tuition hikes. And I guess I'm just wondering what you think students should do politically to take matters into their own hands and help prevent themselves from coming into debt.
Noah, let me ask you, in this student movement against tuition hikes, what were you arguing that the school should spend less on?
I think that in Quebec, there's a lot of evidence of sort of investing the endowment in risky endeavors, and I think that a lot of money was lost, a lot of budget and endowment was lost through these investments.
I see. So it had to do with investing the endowment, maybe in subprime loans or whatever, before the financial crisis, when so many schools lost a lot from their endowments. But what's your answer to this? Because there are so many things that come up. If you watch the Sunday morning political talk shows, you will find Republicans rotating through there regularly saying the reason tuition is going so high is because of student aid.
Right.
That when you add that on top of what the schools know the parents are willing to pay, then that becomes the new tuition.
Right. And this was an argument advanced by Bill Bennett, the education secretary in the 1980s, who said basically if the federal government would stop giving out so much aid, schools wouldn't be able to increase their tuition.
And yet we also hear, very different from that there's an amenities war.
Right.
So in order to attract students, schools are building luxury gyms and all these other things.
And all of this has contributed to the rising cost of college, including the number of support services that have been added on college campuses, you know, the number of health professionals now who take care of students. But the bigger issue, especially at Publix, you know, and 80% of Americans go to public universities, is the decline in state appropriations to colleges and universities. It's now about 50-50 with students paying about half the price of the cost of education, where, you know, just like 10, 15 years ago, it was only about a quarter of what they paid toward the cost of college.
And then how about research? Because people call the show and they say, well, if the schools weren't spending so much on research that my child's tuition money subsidizes, if they were just there or primarily there really to teach, then it would be a lot cheaper.
True at some places. Some places do spend tuition money on research. At the bigger research universities, most of that is coming from the federal government. And if you talk to professors, you know, some professors are better teachers because of what they're researching.
So ultimately, what's your advice for parents sending their kid to a school right now, or, you know, for a student who maybe isn't getting parental support over the next few years, other than read my book, of course?
Ask a lot more questions. I think that parents need to become savvier consumers about the future of higher education. They need to make this less of an emotional decision, and you're making a big purchase. Just like you're making a purchase of a car and making a purchase of a house, you need to ask the same number of questions that you would in those cases.
Jeffrey Salingo, author of College Unbound, The Future of Higher Education and What It Means for Students. Before I let you walk out the door, help me make a segue to the next segment, which is going to be a call-in for parents of college kids asking the parents, how much do you want to know about what your kids are doing partying at school? We saw the story of Wesleyan University sending an email to every parent warning them about the annual tradition that often leads to binge drinking. It's a bike riding and drinking thing that they do there. So since you cover the world of higher ed at the Chronicle, do you have any reaction to that email? Have you seen or thought about this? Is there buzz at the Chronicle of Higher Education office on the way in which schools and parents have to abide a certain amount of stupid behavior?
Well, it always happens. Every school has these traditions, especially around graduation. It's probably best that the parents don't know how their sons and daughters are spending their time when they're back at home paying the bills.
All right. Jeffrey Salingo, thanks a lot.
It's great to be here. Thanks.